from the other side of the world, Manila, Philippines. Just about, matter of fact, from Washington, D.C., the gentleman I talked to back there, if you drive a pin from Washington, D.C. straight through the globe, you're pretty close to the Philippines. It's just about exactly the other side of the world. That's amazing in itself that I'm able to sit here on the other side of the world and talk with you and Dr. Lanza, who has written a book that I'm going to have to ask about because I'm not sure it makes sense. Here we have a hard scientist, a man who literally pioneered stem cell research, such hard science, turning to this theory. I wonder, well, we'll ask in a moment. Dr. Robert Lanza will be right back. Curiosity killed the cat, I guess, right? Schrodinger's cat. Doctor, how does a hard scientist like yourself, a man in the hard sciences, I mean really deeply in the hard sciences, turn and begin thinking about biocentrism, that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, that's exactly what a scientist is supposed to do. He's supposed to follow the experiments and make decisions and try to figure out what the world is all about based on the experiments. And basically what has been going on is that we've been having all these experiments, the science experiment, the two-hole experiment, all these, just sweeping them under the rug. And there's all sorts of very flimsy excuses. So, for instance, everyone says all this weirdness that we've been talking about only happens in the micro world. There are really two worlds, the little world of the atom and then the big world that where you and I live. But the thing here is that that doesn't hold up because there have been new experiments recently that are showing, for instance, there's something called buckyballs, that these huge carbon-60 molecules. And they show that those molecules actually now are following the same rules and properties and the same weirdness that we actually are seeing in the micro world, all the quantum phenomenon. And likewise, even more recent experiments where they use crystals are actually showing that this weirdness is now going into waves up to a half an inch. And there are new experiments actually on the books that are going to show, it's called scaled up quantum superposition, that will actually show, hopefully, that this occurs at the level of tables and chairs of you and I. So we can't just keep ignoring and saying, okay, we'll worry about it and downstream. The experiments are real, and we've got to accept the conclusions. The problem is that goes against everything we've been taught and trained ever since, you know, kindergarten. And so what I'm trying to do as a scientist is to put these experiments together in a way where they don't contradict one another. And the conclusion is actually what the physicists originally concluded, something known as the Copenhagen interpretation, where, again, if you extrapolate the results to the world, you arrive at more or less the same conclusion. They just didn't have an appropriate explanation. And as a biologist, I'm stepping into the equation, and I am saying, yes, that's because you can't explain the world without taking into consideration consciousness, what's going on in terms of our perception of the world, in terms of what's going on in the mind.
Okay, well, if it's going on across the board, even in the larger world that we observe every day, and we finally understand it, how will it impact our world?
Well, again, as I mentioned earlier, I think that you're going to see, once we understand what's going on here, you know, obviously not only in terms of new generation of thinking, you know, machines and whatever, we've seen this, some of this laid out in some of the science fiction movies, but again, I think that, you know, all sorts of human relationships will be altered. I mean, there's many things that we think of as going on in the world that just simply are just wrong based on a false premise. So I think you're going to see all sorts of changes that downstream will basically change civilization as we know it.
Can you give me an example? Things that are going on, you suggested, now.
Well, right now, again, I'm giving you the most concrete example is again the artificial intelligence. I mean, if we want to have a new generation of machines and computers that can think and act like we do, again, we need to understand what is going on and how this works. So I think that as soon as we change our perspective and look at this whole issue of what are these algorithms, what is consciousness, how does that that account for what's going on and what we're observing in the physical world, I think then we can put the piece to get the pie together and at that point be able to create, you know, hopefully not too far downstream, machines, for instance, that can think, the new generation of artificial intelligence. So that's
I've heard some people suggest that consciousness is simply self-awareness. Is that,
well,
is that
I think,
on or off base?
Well, you know, I think, you know, it's part of it. I mean, I actually published a paper with you know, the famous behaviorist B.F. Skinner called Self-Awareness in the Pigeon. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, self-awareness, you know, is part of a consciousness, obviously, because, you know, what is consciousness? It's the me. It's the I feeling. And so, obviously, you're aware of yourself. Now, in lower animals, for instance, that gets a little fuzzy. You know, we showed in our particular experiment that pigeons had self-awareness. But, you know, in the field of psychology, you know, there's several famous experiments where they actually show that only higher primates have this self-awareness. But there are degrees. So we showed in our paper in Science that actually pigeons and even lower animals have certain aspects of that self-awareness. And so, you know, you can dissect what that means. But consciousness, in the way I'm talking about it, is in the big picture. I'm talking about consciousness is actually part of the process of reality as we know it, and it starts to explain what is going on in the world in terms of the foundations of physics, in terms of all these various experiments, you know, that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm. What does all this mean about death?
So, right now, again, we think we just die and rot into the ground, and that's really, you know, a silly idea, and it's really based on, you know, our view that, you know, that, you know, we are associated with bodies and we know that they self-destruct. So again, there are these experiments that collectively suggest that whole view of the world is wrong. In fact, you know, I mentioned some of the quantum physics experiments, but one of the mainstream interpretations actually in the physics community is something known as the many worlds interpretation. And what that states is that there's an infinite number of universes, quote unquote, the multiverse, that correlates with this range of possible observations that we see in the micro world. So everything that can possibly happen occurs in some of those in one of those universes. So in that sense, death doesn't really exist. In all these possible universes, they exist simultaneously, regardless of what happens in any one of them. And what biocentrism actually does is it extends that idea and suggests that life is an unfolding, an adventure that really transcends our linear way of thinking. So although our bodies, again, self-destruct, that me feeling is just energy that operates in the brain. And we know that that energy doesn't go away at death. One of the surest principles of science is that energy never dies. It can never be created or destroyed. And so when we die, we don't die in this random billiard ball matrix, but in what I call the inescapable life matrix. So life has this non-linear dimensionality that transcends any individual history, universe. It's sort of like a perennial flower, you know, that returns to bloom in the multiverse. So like in that science experiment I had mentioned earlier, whether you're flipping a switch or making other choices, it will be you who experiences those various outcomes in resulting universes. So death doesn't really exist in a timeless, spaceless world.
Would you care to speculate on what that is going to mean for us at death in a way we can understand?
Well, you know, I mean, I think it's very much like going into a different room. I think that we know, for instance, you know, that, you know, you can watch a movie and, you know, it's real and it's exciting, but that when it's over, that is over, but it doesn't mean that that goes away. So it's very much like, again, like your vinyl record that, you know, you listen to one song and that's the now, that's the present. And you can move the needle and there will be other places, you know, before or after that, that will be in the now where it is. But just because you listen to one song doesn't mean the other ones don't exist. So I think all the ranges of what's possible are possible. The problem we have in thinking about death, and this is, again, what Einstein was alluding to when he says that the past and present are just, you know, illusions, is that we think of it in this linear way that, you know, we just die and that's it. And that is exactly what's going on with those entangled particles that, you know, the spooky action at a distance and all this. Our whole idea of space and time, we got the foundation wrong. They are the way the mind puts it together. They're not real absolute realities that exist out there, and again, that was what Einstein, you know, introduced into our understanding of the world.
Energy remains, but do you think consciousness continues in a coherent manner?
Yeah. So again, what's going on is there energy itself is just really the foundation, the fundamentals of what we experience in the physical world. So matter, as Einstein said, E=mc², is that matter is energy, vice versa. We know you can create particle, antiparticle pairs from just pure energy, and we know that you can if you introduce an antiparticle with a particle, that they will disintegrate and just into energy itself into electromagnetic waves. So again, we know that everything is made up of energy, and energy is actually motion. It's actually something happening in time, temporal activity in space, a change in space. So again, those are already in the external world. That is how the mind actually, if you dissect what's going on, would be reduced to. And that is what we're studying in these quantum experiments. We're going down, studying actually electromagnetic energy itself, waves, particles of electromagnetic energy are called photons. And those are the particles, for instance, that we're studying in many of these experiments.
So death, as we perceive it, is, I don't know, just our own perception. There's no real death, if what you're saying is accurate.
Right. I mean, think about it. Death requires there to be time out there, some invisible matrix that, you know, we don't see out there just ticking away. And that's silly. That's just simply not what's going on out there. So again, if time isn't this external thing that's just out there, then that's how come we think of death. We think of that, well, when I die, you know, after me, and that's again why you're running into all these same contradictions. You know, why are we on top of infinity right now, on top of all of time? I mean, again, lots of very silly ideas. Why the Big Bang? You know, what happened the day before the Big Bang? I mean, these are all silly questions that are based on a wrong understanding of space and time. And Immanuel Kant, like I said, laid this out in his Critique of Pure Reason a long time ago, but it was so heavy. Now, I know people recognize him as a genius, but actually there's a fun little story that when he Hubert Spencer, actually, who was one of the great philosophers at the time, when he read his book, threw it on the ground and said, he's a stupid man. And it turns out that even his one of his top colleagues, when he got the manuscript when Immanuel Kant sent it to him, got halfway through it and gave it back to him, and he said, this is just too barbarous for me to read, and said, I can't understand this. So the problem is that we think very superficially, and we open our eyes, the world is there, and we don't really think much further than that. I mean, again, as I mentioned earlier, we're like a chipmunk or a squirrel. So I think that this is part of the problem, and I think that what we're confronted with now are new experiments that are now saying, well, you know, unless you keep ignoring the experiments, this is the way it is. And so we need to change our worldview, the way we see things. And time, again, being this object or invisible matrix out there, is just silly. It's wrong. And at some point, I think, you know, we're going to have to accept these experiments and realize that.
Well, all right. 1 second before the Big Bang. That is an important question, because I know you're saying it isn't, but it is, because we want to know if there was a hand that created it, or whether it was just, I don't know, and nobody knows. But it does seem like an important question. You sort of dismissed it, but there was no time until there were objects. When there were objects, we could look at the movement of those objects and measure the movement. Hence, there was time. When you have movement, you can measure. You then have time, right?
So, yeah, okay. So let's just think of this in steps. Okay, right now, as we know from the experiment, particle, no particle that you can possibly observe has any properties until you observe it. So that means only now, when you're observing something, does a particle actually manifest itself. This is the two-hole experiment. When you look at it, you see it, it acts like the board, it goes through that hole. But if you don't look at it, the reason it can go through all these holes at the same time is simple. It's what we, in physics, they call a probability wave. It means it's just potential. And so, therefore, it's only when you decide to observe what happened to it that it will actually collapse and have basically done something, because, you know, the probability waves are not real things. They're just statistical projections. So, again, what's going on here are that we right now look out at the room, you see an object, okay? You're sitting on a chair. Now, you're sitting on a chair, and you know that chair is on the Earth, which is spinning around on its axis, and that's going around the sun, which is going around in the Milky Way, and that's in the universe. And you can project exactly all the spatial logic until you come to the known and edge of the known universe. So that's an exhaustive extrapolation of the logic of you right now talking to me on the phone. Now, you can take, okay, you can say, okay, well, you and I are made up of molecules. Say, for instance, carbon. Now, carbon, we know from, you know, your basic science books, is formed in the heart of exploding supernova, which are formative events in the universe. And if you extrapolate all that back, all that logic back to its ultimate extreme, you come back to a singularity where, you know, matter goes down into its smaller components, the plasma and the nuclei and the electrons, and then eventually down to nothing. So if you think of the universe, sort of think of it like one of those globes that you used to have in the schoolroom. You think of the world, and that round sphere is just a concept of, in theory, if you were to be everywhere on this planet, this is what you'd have, is this round ball. But it doesn't mean that, you know, you can go to Antarctica or whatever. Likewise, the universe is a concept. It's basically all the logic associated with your existence. And so, again, right now you're sitting on the chair, I can extrapolate all the way out to the edge of the known universe. But as John Wheeler pointed out, even light coming from the edge of the universe, the past will not be determined until it's observed. And so when you observe it, you're actually, in this guy was the guy, again, who coined the word black hole, wormhole. I mean, this guy was not a dope. He was actually one of the colleagues working with Einstein. He says that when you observe that, you actually are determining what path that light took billions of years ago. So again, this is hard to wrap your mind around, and even Stephen Hawking now, again, as I mentioned earlier, is changing his perspective and is now having to agree, obviously based on the data, that what happens now in the present actually does impact our history and universe. And so what happened before the Big Bang, you're talking about at the end of the extrapolation. The extrapolation goes back to nothing. So those are just the theoretical way our mind would say, if we were to go and project back, all the way back in the logic, this would be the complete logic that explains who you are. Does that make sense?
I know. I'm not sure.
That's a lot of information. And this is exactly why, you know, physicists and the scientists are struggling, you know, so hard with, you know, these newer experiments.
And so, would there or would there not be consciousness involved in the Big Bang? I almost said creation, but I'll say the Big Bang.
So again, the whole the whole thing again is when you think about the Big Bang, it's really no different than looking at the moon or looking at your chair. Again, without an observer, not a single particle, whether it was in the Big Bang or in your chair, whether it's part of the moon or your kitchen, has any definite properties. So until they're observed, they exist only in what we call probability waves, or they're only the potential. So again, as in, you know, the two-hole experiment, which again goes to the core of this whole issue, is that those particles basically will not go through one hole or the other until you look at them. And
right,
until you do that, They could be.
Doctor, hold it right there. I'm sorry. We're at a break. But there was no, prior to the Big Bang, there was no mass, right? So let me think about that. I'm Art Bell. Heartaches and headaches. That's what you'll get from trying to think about what we're talking about tonight. My guest has been compared to Einstein, Robert Lanza, Dr. Robert Lanza, and he is a pioneer in stellar research. I'm going to ask him about that. We'll get to that. But if I think along the lines of what Dr. Lanza is saying, and I consider the Big Bang, prior to the Big Bang, there was, we'll see if he agrees, no mass, so there was no gravity, and there was no time. Because time is a construct, according to Dr. Lanza, in our own minds, right? So Big Bang, no mass, no gravity. My question would be, if that is so, and I bet he agrees, perhaps not with this part, then how did the Big Bang happen without conscious direction or without consciousness being involved? Because at that time there was nobody, well, none of us anyway, to observe, right? So there must have been consciousness involved with the Big Bang. Certainly wouldn't be our consciousness, would it? Dr. Robert Lanza, back in a moment. Well, all right, let's try it out. So, Doctor, the Big Bang, prior to that, no mass, hence no gravity. And I guess my question would be, how did the Big Bang happen without consciousness of some sort being involved?
Well, I think, well, part of the problem here is that we're thinking in terms of the old paradigm, and we know the world just isn't out there independent of the observer. So again, that indeed is consciousness. So that when you think about whether, you know, it's the early part of the universe or even earlier, all the way back to the Big Bang, that is basically what you would see if in fact you were there. So in fact, if you were the observer, you could actually trace back you talking to me right now, all the way back theoretically to the moment where the logic is that actually comes to an end. So if you think about right now, you're a human being, you're made up of the carbon molecules. Again, some of those molecules were made, along the way, during the evolution of the Milky Way and other earlier stages. And then just after the Big Bang, actually, as you go back in time, actually the atoms start to then the components that actually made up atoms were formed, so the electrons and the nuclei, they were formed. Then you can go back even further to, there are different particles inside those particles that in theory go all the way back. And then just before that, when you come to the bottom of that whole the backwards in evolution, you come to the point of where the logic starts. So it's basically an extrapolation of our own existence, of our spatial temporal thing. So again, it's like that round globe we were talking about. You have the globe, and in theory you could go to Antarctica, but until you don't know whether you can really get there, and so you could probably never go back to the Big Bang. It's only theoretical. So, but that is in theory what you would see. But so if there is no observer, there is no reality, and nothing. So before the Big Bang, is meaningless. It has no meaning because, in fact, at that point, you've gone to the bottom. Just like
right, but the Big Bang has meaning, and without anybody to observe it,
there would be nothing.
There would be nothing. So, how did it even in fact occur without a conscious direction?
And you're exactly it. And if there's nothing, then there was nothing there to observe it. And so you're getting into this sort of circular words. Our languages and our science are very primitive tools. So what happens is that in physics they say that everything exists in this probability state, and it's not until you observe it that anything at any point in the universe or any place in the universe could exist. And that applies in whether it's just after the instance of the Big Bang, if you want to talk about it that way, or in the future or the present, or whether it's on the moon or here on Earth, everything, even according to even the experiments in the micro world, they're probability states. And not until the observer is involved, and again, that's because reality is a process that involves our consciousness, they're not there. But anything that is part of that spatial temporal logic indeed would only exist, you know, obviously through the process of consciousness. I know this is
you know, it's okay, I'm with you until we begin talking about that Big Bang. And
right.
How did the Big Bang even occur without conscious observation?
Well, again, this is it. The Big Bang no more occurs than anything else. So again, John Wehrer's line, no phenomena is a real phenomena until it's an observed phenomena. So whether you're talking about the Big Bang or your table or your chair, again, every one of those particles is just an uncertainty wave, and they don't have real particles and real properties until they're observed. So whether you're talking about now or the Big Bang, nothing changes. Is that making any sense?
I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's tough because
I'm not sure. In other words, nothing is until it is observed, and yet we know the Big Bang occurred.
Well, we don't
though
know
we that. Didn't though we didn't observe it. Your theory suggests that it was observed,
No, not at all. No, I'm not saying.
No.
As a matter of fact, what even John Wehrer was saying is that there's light reaching the Earth today from distant parts of the universe that didn't even exist, and when you see them, only then did the path of that light and the existence of that light actually happen. So there are probably many physicists who would also agree, possibly even Stephen Hawking, that the point is this whole parts of the history of our universe that until they're observed, they don't exist. And it's uncertainty. That's, again, one of the foundations of quantum theory in physics is that there's uncertainty in virtually any possible event. And until you observe it, that uncertainty doesn't go away. So anything in the past, as in that science experiment, what you do right now, again, in that experiment, they actually sent particles into it, and it was what you did now in the present actually could change what happened in the past. So this uncertainty, and again, this is the now Stephen Hawking's new top-down cosmology, that you have to have the present before you can have the history. And so again, this is the problem with the Big Bang, is that we're used to thinking of the universe in reverse, that it was this Big Bang and there were all these little molecules bouncing around, and here we are. And in fact, that's wrong. The problem is that you need to, it actually goes in the other direction. It's the observer creates the properties of the particles and the causality that's associated with that then has collapsed. The probability wave for the whole universe, for our whole history, at that point take on a real form, if that makes any sense.
Well, then it would suggest there is a power or property in consciousness that we don't understand at all just yet.
Well, this is exactly yet. I mean, what has happened, unfortunately, is that science has just made it like this big black box, and so they try to come up with these theories of everything and try to explain the Big Bang, and they try to explain the universe, and without any reference to consciousness, which is exactly the problem. And exactly all the experiments, even Einstein with his space and time, he knows that they're relative to the observer. So that's exactly what's going on. It's until we tackle the problem of consciousness, we cannot know what's going on in the physical world. We won't, and our theories will not make sense, and they will never make sense until we understand consciousness.
Yeah, I might be willing to go along with that. And we're not very close to it, are we?
No, not until we change our mindset. I mean, I think that, you know, the fact, you know, that you recognize the importance of consciousness, I think this is the kind of thing we need to try to convey to get people to understand that, again, you know, you can't just dismiss consciousness as this little pesky thing, sort of like, you know, a biologist would swat a mosquito in your way. It's a very real problem, not just for biology, but for physicists as well.
There seem to be suggestions that consciousness may be able, for example, mass-directed consciousness may be able to affect complex things like the weather. It certainly can't dissolve the desk in front of me, nor the phone, nor the electronics I have in front of me right now. Can't do any of that. But these complex systems, like the weather, and other things seem to be able to be affected by consciousness. Now, I realize that's out on a limb, but that's where I live, out on a limb. Have you thought about that at all?
Well, again, you know, I'm schooled in, you know, all the dogma of science. So, you know, I, you know, only can go very cautiously into certain areas. And so I've only ventured the first step of the way. But certainly, again, we know that every aspect of the weather is obviously has something to do with your consciousness. Obviously, whether it's color, the brightness, or whatever, all of those things are you know, cannot be divorced from your consciousness. Now, whether or not we can manipulate them, again, we do know at the micro level that your choices and what you think and what you can do can impact to a certain degree, what happens to the properties of those particles. Now, whether or not you can manipulate in any way the weather and how that might work out in terms of causality, you know, that's beyond me. But, you know, maybe someday we'll figure out if there's something to it. Like I said, I mean, there's so much we don't understand, and, you know, we only probably understand less than 1% of what's really going on. So who am I to actually say what could really be going on or potentially be possible?
Well, Doctor, considering your background, even the small, what you call the small step you've taken is a gigantic step, and I imagine it's caused all kinds of controversy. In other words, I would think that a lot of the people in the hard sciences are pounding on you for what you're saying in this book.
Well, absolutely. The problem, too, that makes it doubly difficult is that every time they criticize the idea, they're criticizing it from within the old paradigm, which, of course, mm-hmm. makes no sense. And so they'll actually say something to me that actually has nothing to do whatsoever with the way it's being presented in this new system. So I think this is nothing new. Anytime you have a new world view, I think it was actually Arthur Schopenhauer once was famous for having said that, I'm trying to think of the exact quote. It was something about all truths go through three phases. First, they're ridiculed, then they're violently opposed, and then they're accepted as self-evident. And I think anytime you introduce any new idea, they're going to go through that phase. And I think I've gotten the ridicule and, you know, and now violently opposed. And the next thing you know is that once people start to realize that, you know, you can put the clock better together better this way, that then they'll say, oh, well, that's self-evident. You know, we've known about this. People have been saying this for thousands of years. And this is the problem. You can get accused of pseudoscience if you're too far apart from the existing science. And on the other hand, if you're not sufficiently different, then, you know, they'll just say it's old news. So you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place.
Mm-hmm. Well, you jumped in between the rock and the hard place by writing this book. Did you think long and hard before you wrote this?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult because, again, you know, I mean, you know, I'm not totally stupid, and I realize, you know, I grew up in this society, and I know, you know, you walk down the street, and the street's there, and the moon is there, and believe me, I mean, that's how, you know, I grew up with that same world view, and then when I started to see the contradictions, and that it just didn't add up, and then started to consider the experiments, you start to move, and you go, well, you know, we haven't moved far enough, and then I knew that you're going to run up against, you know, remember, ever since we were little kids, you know, we get bombarded through our books, our schools, and all, with all these ideas, and it's, you can't just throw them away. So, yeah, when I wrote this, I knew I would get hammered. I knew I would get slammed. And so I tried as best I could to explain it in terms that I thought people could understand. And Todd, unfortunately, to explain it, like, you know, in a few minutes or even an hour. And so that's why I wrote the book. But if you don't read the book, then what happens is you trip up very easily. In other words, showing someone the nucleus of a new worldview. And it's like walking around in the dark. You can trip and stumble, and you go, well, this is silly because of this or that. And you can come up with all sorts of reasons and ways to refute this because, you know, you're unfamiliar with it. And every time you try to think of something, you revert back to the way you were trained to think. So
all right, look, we're at near the end of our 2 hours. That's how quickly it goes. Now, if you're unable to stay any longer, there are a couple of questions I've got to ask you. Can you stay longer or not?
I can add on another 10, 15 minutes if you'd like. Yeah.
10 or 15 minutes. That's not much. All right.
Okay.
You were part of the team that cloned the world's first early stage human embryos for the purpose of generating embryonic stem cells. So we all know about all the controversy involved in that. What I would like to ask you is where we are now with adult stem cells replacing fetal cells for the purpose of cloning. Are adult stem cells going to end up to be as useful as fetal?
Well, what is happening is you know, obviously there are embryonic and fetal tissue, and there's also the adult, and there are pluses and minuses for each of those. I mean, we've been actually using adult stem cells for bone marrow transplants, for instance, for cancer, for literally decades. So we know that they work very nicely. The problem with those is that you can't make all the types of cells and tissues you would like to try to cure various diseases. So they have limitations. But what has happened is that there's been a very remarkable breakthrough very recently that hopefully is going to solve all of these problems. It turns out that we can actually make stem cells just like those fetal or embryonic ones from adult tissue. We can take a skin cell, and actually we've now learned how to do sort of what an egg or what an embryo does in terms of actually having this plasticity to become every type of a cell. So if I take a skin cell, I can actually upregulate certain genes and make it now a stem cell, just like an embryonic stem cell, and it can make all the tissues of the body. So that's where we're at now, and this is what we called iPS cells. Induced pluripotent stem cells. And so we're on the verge now of hopefully getting that technology to work in a way that we can now use it in the clinic to help people. In fact, I just published a paper a few months back showing that we can now actually make those kinds of human stem cells using proteins in a way that's safe, because the way it was originally discovered a couple of years ago was using viruses, which, of course, the FDA would never allow you to use in people. So we're moving very quickly, and I think you're going to start seeing some treatments appearing very, very soon. In fact, we've applied with the FDA to start to try to treat blindness using retinal cells that we made from these embryonic stem cells, and hopefully we'll start clinical trials this year on that. But we're also in the process of now using the iPS cells that were actually created from adult skin cells. And so I think you're going to see a lot of exciting things happening very soon.
So the answer is yes and no. In other words, yes, eventually adult stem cells will be what you use, but at the moment there are still properties in fetal cells that simply have not yet been...
Well,
I'm not sure how to phrase this. Haven't been... What? The adult stem cells are not yet quite as useful as the embryonic ones?
Yeah, so again, in the scientific community, in the stem cell field, what we call an adult stem cell is a cell that you get from the body, and it's normally in all your tissues. So, for instance, your skin, you have stem cells, and in your brain, you have stem cells that can make the various brain cells. And those cells are very limited in that, say, for instance, a brain or a nerve stem cell can only make other kinds of nerve cells. So we're now learning how to turn those cells in so they can do everything.
Doctor, hold tight. We're at a break point, and then I'm going to steal 10 more minutes from you, and then we'll go to open line. So, Doctor, hold tight. Dr. Robert Lanza is my guest. Biocentrism is his book. I suggest if you want to know more and really understand biocentrism, you go buy the book.